the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
And so it starts this evening. The English Premier League is back. We are going to give it the entire last word on sport this evening. We're joined by Gavin Cooney from the Irish Times, Dion Fanning, co-host of the Free State podcast. But to start, Tony Cascarino, who of course has been with us for so many years in our Premier League coverage here on The Last Word. So, Tony, what in particular are you looking forward to in this year's season?
Well, I do think there's a lot of teams that are going to play front foot, you know, football, Matt. I really believe a lot of teams are going to attack and there's going to be a lot of it. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't think we're going to see too many teams park the bus, even teams that got promoted. I don't see Coventry doing that, certainly. Ipswich have been very, very bold in the transfer market. You know, Gary O'Neill spent the best part of 150 million, a bit similar to what, you know, Sunderland did the year before. I just see a lot of teams going for the opposition and probably away from home as well. Think of Brighton that we've seen. We've seen Crystal Palace do that over recent years as well, and others. So, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm a little bit surprised by that, Tony, because I would have thought last year was a little bit disappointing and that a lot of the football was sort of industrial or agricultural. There was a big dependence on set-piece goals, particularly from corners and from throw-ins. There was an awful lot of killing the game with goalkeepers going down, feigning injury to disrupt the flow of the game. What makes you confident that this year will be better?
Because they've changed the rules, Matt, slightly, haven't they? You know, the towel from the, you know, the throw-ins and then the time you need to get off the pitch. You know, they're pushing players to get off a lot quicker. I think they recognise that too many teams have slowed the game down. And some teams were more guilty than others last year. I mean, Brentford did it brilliantly well. And obviously Arsenal. But there's others. I think they've tried to quicken things up. Look, we won't know the actual outcome, Matt, until, you know, sort of a number of games have been played. But I do think they have tried to say, look, not slow play as we would have in golf. I think they want to make the game quicker.
Dion, we have a ban on things like expected goals on this show. We don't get into that sort of nonsense. But the amount of time ball is in play, I think, is a legitimate one to look at, because there were lots of matches last year when you were looking at it and you're going, how often is the ball actually in play, or how long are we waiting for a throw-in or a corner to be taken?
Yeah, and like the idea that, like, the rules, the interpretation of the rules have changed, and, you know, Howard Webb is out, is prominently talking, as he always is, about what they're going to do differently. But whether those things are enforced longer than the first couple of weeks of the season remains to be seen. And it reminds me, there was a famous time, it was nearly 20 years ago now, when the Premier League launched a Respect the Ref campaign. And there was, you know, it was kind of heavily backed by the Daily Mail, and there was this big kind of media onslaught about how we need to respect the ref. And I think one match, Manchester United played Liverpool at Old Trafford, Javier Mascherano, who didn't read the Daily Mail, clearly, sort of verbally abusing the referee and got sent off and couldn't believe it. But this was the only person who was sanctioned during this Respect the Ref campaign. And, you know, this is the problem with some of these things. There are so many directives. English football is addicted to sort of a certain type of bureaucratic procedure. And I would argue that Arsenal capitalized on that by being a very bureaucratic team themselves last year. We saw how they were in constant contact over the course of the season with the Referees Association, asking them, you know, what would their interpretation be of certain situations, and they gamed it like that. So it was a very methodical, kind of almost rugby style approach to football, which nobody wants to see. And I think those things need to really be changed. But I don't know if what they're doing now is going to actually create the environment for that, and whether the teams, as you say, Matt, the teams are so geared now to set pieces, taking so long at corners, all these things that actually take the momentum out of the game and have changed the pace of the game. And one of the things that have changed the pace of the game as well, and I don't want to talk about VAR, but in terms of it slowing down the speed of the game, allowing teams to take rest during a game. It has had a huge impact, and it has had a huge impact in terms of the stop-start nature of football.
Well, you may not want to talk about VAR, but I do. So, Gavin Cooney, I'm leaving that to you, because I think one of the big complaints that fans have had, especially last year, was the amount of time it's taking to make a decision. And also sometimes the little bit of the joy that's actually taken out of celebrating a goal. It's almost like waiting to see if you can really celebrate it to be sure that it has passed the VAR check.
So every year, Howard Webb comes out and does his press conference or gives his interviews about what the Premier League refs will be focusing on for the season ahead, as Dion referenced there. And often what comes out in advance of the last few seasons, at least, was that there will be a higher threshold for going to VAR. We're not going to use it for this and that. It's going to have to be a very clear and obvious error, or now there will be a high bar of intervening. And the latest euphemism was the referee's decision. If you want to take that to its logical end, the referee saying we'll improve VAR by using it less, take it to its end and improve it for good by not using it at all. You know, it has made such a fundamental change to the game. So, you know, it's not just the Premier League. In Premier League, obviously, we focus in on VAR a lot because we watch and talk about the Premier League more than any other league, really, that uses it. But it doesn't really work. You know, it's just changed the game so much.
Did it work in the World Cup, or was it that it seemed to work better in the early stages of the World Cup, and then as the tournament progressed, it became a bit more like the English Premier League in the way they used it?
Just because they used it less and less, you know, it's still run, you know, the computers are still watched by humans. You know, AI hasn't fully got rid of us just yet, and therein lies the problem. There's such subjective means for intervention. The one that sticks out from the World Cup was the disallowing of the Egypt goal against Argentina for a foul having, you know, okay, maybe it was technically a foul, but, you know, look at the context. They had ignored that foul plenty of times previously, not just in that game, but other games as well. So it's just the subjectivity of it. And it also means, you know, we must remember that the rules were not written really to be so strictly enforced. They're really there as a guide to allow the game to be played. And now, because we've got VAR to digest everything from multiple angles in slow motion, we need objective means of everything. And I was listening to Rory Smith on with Dion on Second Captains this week, talking about one of the latest rule directives is around hair pulling. So you'll remember that there was this epidemic of hair pulling in the Premier League last season, a real stain on the game. And everyone was automatically given a red card for hair pulling. But now it has been decided by the Premier League refs that, well, not all hair pulls are equal. So now the player must be seen making a yanking motion. I'll say that very carefully on radio. So now we're going to, honestly, you'll be sitting down this season watching the Premier League. Someone will pull someone's hair and you'll hear an adult in the commentary booth genuinely sit down and soberly say, I'm not sure that meets the threshold of a yank. Again, I say that very carefully. Now, obviously, Cucurella has left Chelsea.
Because we're
trying
to talk about Americans, yes.
Cucurella has left Chelsea, which probably does kind of, you know, he had the most yankable hair in the Premier League.
Or Dominic Calvert-Lewin.
Yeah, you're put upon Dominic Calvert-Lewin. So he's still there, obviously, with Leeds. So I think that just goes to show some of the kind of absurdity we're at with VAR. It's like, you know, remember Father Ted trying to hammer out the dent in the car with the hammer, and obviously all of a sudden take the wide-angle lens and the whole thing is a scrap heap. It just doesn't really work. But we've got to put up with it anyway in the name of progress.
Before we get to all the teams and the managers and the transfers, one other bugbear, Tony. Does anyone actually know really what a handball is anymore?
No, not really. It's a tough one, Matt. I mean, I get frustrated with some of the types of penalties that have been given. And I've said to you all along, for years, Matt, I've gone on about penalties and how I dislike them. I've even suggested getting rid of them because, you know, the handball, you can have someone at an angle and whether they're inside the box or not, and it's a slight touch of the hand. It's really, really tough, Matt. Just on going a little bit back on VAR, and one of the issues I had, I was an advocate of VAR. I thought it would work differently from what it did. But the end product was nowhere near what I had imagined. And that has been an issue. And handballs fall in that criteria for me where how – you know, we've gone from the sleeve to, you know, to having your arms out, and then you've got players literally tucking their arms in as they run up, and if it's the bottom of their hand, you know, and deflection onto a hand as well, which, how can you give a penalty if it's deflected from a, you know, another player onto your arm, where you have literally zero chance of being able to get your arms out of the way anyway? I've just found it very frustrating, Matt. There seems no common sense rule around handball, and penalties in themselves, well, they're the bane on my, you know, my talking about football. I just find them painful, because I always look at it, Matt, if you're doing a 12-yard shot on a one-on-one against the goalkeeper, that is a huge advantage for an attacker, when you're talking ultimately about a coin flip decision that gives you a way higher advantage if you get the penalty.
Dion, will you indulge me with one other little pedantic complaint I'm going to make, right?
Okay, go on. I might have some of my own, man.
Oh, well, you could add them in. But one of mine now is the placing of the ball for corner kicks. And this idea that, you know, even if it's sort of a blade of grass touches the ball, which is clearly outside the quadrant, it's inside the quadrant for the corner kick.
Yeah, well, I guess they're talking about the whole of the ball. And, you know, if you look at it like that, some of the ball is hanging over the quadrant, so they might argue it like that. But yeah, it's one of those things you have to make your peace with. Right? but I would say I think the one thing, and I agree with everything Tony and Gavin have said about VAR, and you know, it is significant that Howard Webb is out there, because this is, as I said, a bureaucracy. Like, there is too much, not just intervention from VAR, but there is too much prominence to the whole dynamic of VAR, and too much provenance to Howard Webb. Like, the PGMOL have rebranded this year. They're no longer called the PGMOL, they're called ProRef. Now, why do they need to rebrand? Like, in what world is a rebranding of a referee body making anyone's lives better? Like, it doesn't do anything for anybody, except it's just an insight into that world of corporate speak that they operate in. And, you know, and I was looking, like Howard Webb said on the back of their rebranding, that they were now creating an environment focused on high performance, and that it was fundamental to enhancing refereeing standards.
So what had been going on before? So,
well, yeah, exactly. But it's just, there is a prominence given to this, that is draining, and it is given to it because VAR has become the most significant character in so many games. And again, you know, this isn't an original point, but it's significant that last year's Premier League was decided on after the VAR box after an incident at West Ham Arsenal, rather than say Manchester City QPR in 2012, and the Aguero moment. We are now waiting to see what some bureaucrats decide is a great moment or not. And that is fundamentally wrong.
God, Gavin, are we looking forward to this new Premier League season or not now with all of this?
No, I am looking forward to it. I do actually think it's quite a low-quality Premier League season, but that may be good for it.
It's sort of a Premier League season, isn't it, without superstars.
Without stars, they're all gone.
Except for Haaland at Manchester City. And you sort of wonder, how much ball is Haaland going to get?
It's amazing. Like, look back at the World Cup, and all of the individual stars of that World Cup are playing elsewhere. And I don't blame any superstar for not wanting to play in the Premier League, because the schedule is unforgiving. Like, you're playing really tough match every 3-4 days, and it's become so physical and so draining. Better to be a Paris Saint-Germain, where you can play the Champions League and then, you know, kind of job share in Ligue 1 at a weekend, you know. So, and the, you know, the Premier League then did market itself on its superstar managers, but the greatest of all time is now gone with Guardiola. So in that vacuum of stars obviously creates a lot of uncertainty, and I don't think we've ever had a season where there's been such uncertainty about the big teams aside from Arsenal. I have no real idea what to expect from Manchester City, from Liverpool, from Chelsea, from Manchester United to a certain extent, even from Tottenham. So from that perspective, I'm absolutely intrigued as to how it all plays out.
Need to take a break. Back more with Gavin Cooney, Dion Fanning and Tony Cascarino after this. Welcome back. Tony Cascarino, let's start going through the main contenders for the Premier League with you. And there seems to be, almost a consensus emerging that it's Arsenal's. You know, that's it. Arsenal have the best squad. Everybody else is in turmoil when it comes to transfers in and out and managers. Arsenal are only adding players. They'll be better for having the experience of having won last year. Is it as clear cut as that?
Well, I'd say, Matt, if you go midfield and at the back as well, the back line, incredibly strong, especially if they get Konsa over the line from Villa as well. You're looking at a very, very difficult team to play against. And then you can add in Raya, who was quite clearly, for me, the best goalkeeper last year. You know, that defensive, then midfield with a huge amount of players. And obviously, Gramiro has been added into that midfield as well. I don't think they got the strongest front three. I think all of us would probably say there's better front threes. You know, and I know they played Man City last weekend in Community Shield. But I think Doku, Haaland, certainly in Semenyo, is a better front three than Arsenal's. Although that wasn't the case last weekend. And other teams, I think, you know, especially Chelsea, I look at Chelsea and go, Pedro, you know, and then you look at, you know, the likes of Cole Palmer, Morgan Rogers as a three. So I think Arsenal is not so strong at the top end of the pitch. I don't think it matters that much, though, Matt, with the way Arsenal play. And I think they'll just keep a lot of games really tight and we'll be able to keep a clean sheet very often.
OK, what do you think, Dion, of Arsenal? I mean, and is there a possibility that they might buy a top-level striker still between now and the end of the transfer window? Is there anyone really available at their level?
I'm not sure, like, you know, clearly they were talking about adding a kind of a layer of extravagance onto their team, which hasn't happened. But I think they, like, when you look around, when you look around the contenders, and this is it, this is the thing about Arsenal, they aren't particularly attractive Premier League champions. They're not a scintillating team that you think of, are going to stop, you know, are going to wipe away all comers. But they have incredible depth in their squad. They have extraordinary cover in all positions, and they know how to just get, you know, to get results. And when you look at them against the opposition, that is enough. And I think even if they were to get, like, I think even a top player coming into that side, would, you know, I think they would need to commit wholly to what it is Arteta wants from his players. We saw with Eze last year when he was left out of the side after, you know, making a couple of mistakes and not being, you know, focused on the key principles of the Arsenal team. So that is what Arteta stresses. And he can talk as much as he likes about, you know, wanting to bring a bit of star quality into it or whatever. But he's wedded to that and he's never going to change or move away from that.
OK, what about Manchester City, Gavin, who, of course, were the closest contenders last year? But as I've already said, Guardiola's gone. Rodri and Bernardo Silva gone from midfield. An awful lot more of the fringe players have been moved on as well. They seem to be getting some extraordinary prices for selling these players as well. But is there a sense of a real turmoil at Manchester City? And a manager in Maresca, okay, who might be less volatile, shall we say, than Guardiola, certainly judging by the videos going around from this new documentary series, but may not necessarily inspire the team either.
It's very hard to follow Guardiola, obviously. Whether it's turmoil, it's a period of really extraordinary transition. I can't believe that they've allowed Rodri go in the same summer as Guardiola. You know, I mean, obviously Guardiola was the great genius of that team, but the brain on the pitch was Rodri, followed after that by Bernardo Silva. So for to allow them all to leave in one summer, I think is very, very risky. We saw it is possible to replace a great man manager. We saw Arne Slot come in after Jurgen Klopp and win the league in his first season. But that was a perfect kind of aligning of, you know, they didn't change the squad, you know, and that squad still had all of Klopp's characteristics, his good habits, the culture he imbued within them. And Slot came in and tweaked a couple of things and won the league. And the longer Slot had and the more time passed that allowed that Klopp culture ebb away, Liverpool ended up in the mess they were in last season. City are changing everything in one summer. So I think there's, you know, any team with Erling Haaland and any team with the budget of Manchester City should obviously be targeting winning the league. But honestly, I think, you know, I think there's a chance that they could fall a long way. I actually wouldn't be surprised if they're, you know, if it's April next year and they're in a fight to get into the Champions League places in fourth or fifth. I think they've changed so much. At the moment, they've not recruited a huge amount. Elliot Anderson from Nottingham Forest for a king's ransom. And apart from that, not a huge amount. We expect them to sign Bouadi, the Moroccan teenage midfielder who impressed so much at the World Cup, as an effective Rodri replacement. But it's a lot to throw him into his debut Premier League season and expect him to replace, you know, a Ballon d'Or winning midfielder. So there's a huge amount of transition in one go. I'm surprised they've allowed it all to happen in the same summer. And as a result, I think that their chief target this season should merely be consolidating themselves in the Champions League places rather than challenging Arsenal for the league.
Tony, could Maresca be to Guardiola what David Moyes was to Alex Ferguson?
Well, it's going to be a tough one. And all the things that Gavin just said, I totally echo. And just going back on Rodri, Matt, where you have to be brave on making a call. When Rodri done his ACL, he came back and he took him a hell of a long time to get back and recover from that ACL injury. He didn't look the same, Matt. I'd done a number of games last year, in certainly from October onwards, and he was nowhere near the Rodri of what we saw this summer in the World Cup. And he still wasn't a firm fixture in the team. So you have to go the second part of last season where he started to improve, and by the end he was playing closer to what we know Rodri's about. But they could have offered him a deal way before that, but I thought they were waiting on whether he'd ever be back to his best. And of course, then afterwards, you look like you've got egg on your face. He ends up having the World Cup that he did. And then you're left with a scenario that you're going to lose him. So it's a really tough one on City, because they have lost so much. Maresca is going to go for Fernandes. I'm absolutely sure that he's going to try and get Fernandes out of Chelsea, Matt. You know, they're selling players. I mean, the fees they're getting, like you said, is incredible. Servinho, I mean, he had a really indifferent time, could hardly get in the team. And they're getting way more money than they paid for him from Spurs. Spurs are paying at least 30% over the top. And it could be Marmoush as well going from City to Spurs. So, yeah, they are getting big fees. But I still think there'll be legroom in City to buy again. Would I see them coming out of the top four? It would be a hard call, but as Gavin alluded to, that you know, this is a real tough one for Maresca to follow the incredible Guardiola.
I'm going to stay with you for a moment, Tony, because I know how much you love Liverpool, and Liverpool did not get the return from the major investment in strikers last year, and now Mo Salah is gone, and there are concerns particularly about the defence. What do you think Iriola will be able to do? Because I see even today he's going on about the squad been light on numbers.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, especially down the right side of the pitch, you're looking at, you know, Bradley been out forever. You know, Frimpong, can he do that job? I would say they probably need another midfielder, especially if Curtis Jones does go to Inter, if that gets over the line, which look like it's going to happen. Liverpool are light. And they're going to rely. One thing I'm keeping my fingers crossed as a fan, Matt, is that Isak and obviously Wirtz, what we saw of them last year, and they were both plagued by injury. Obviously, Isak by quite a serious one. And then they've lost Ekitike. Them two have to deliver. If Liverpool could have any chance of making Champions League football, them two have to be literally the money that they spent, be the players they were, one at Bayer Leverkusen and one of them, the other one being at Newcastle. They're going to have to play to that level for Liverpool to have any chance. I'm looking forward to seeing Rio Ingemola come into the team, Matt, and again, as a young lad, have an opportunity. But Liverpool, for me, it's going to be a push to whether they can make that top four. I think it's if they start slowly and they don't quite get going, Liverpool are going to have a long season.
Okay, just on Liverpool to you, Dion. If we get time, hopefully we will talk a little bit about how few Irish players there are in the Premier League this year. And I think that traditionally we always would have expected the likes of Liverpool, Manchester United, to have some Irish players there. I know Conor Bradley is there at Liverpool, but he's out injured at present. But even for a sense of identity, a lot of stuff going on at the moment about the change of ownership and Jeff Bezos coming in. But if Curtis Jones is sold, I don't think there's anybody from Liverpool, anybody local, left in the team. Surely that should matter to a club like Liverpool.
Of course it should matter. Now, Liverpool, like, I think it's the first time in the Premier League that I haven't had a player born in Liverpool. But I think there were probably periods in their history when they didn't have players born in Liverpool. They always had, you know, a lot of Scottish players and a lot of Irish players. But that was also wrapped up in the identity of the city of Liverpool. I think the change in identity is obviously as significant in terms of what's happening off the field and the Jeff Bezos deal, which, once it passes, once the independent football regulator, gets his teeth into it, I'm sure that'll, he'll really go through it with a fine tooth comb. But once that's passed, that is a significant change for Liverpool. To have someone like Bezos taking now what's turned out to be close to 40% of being part of a consortium that's taking close to 40%, and it looks inevitable that within a year they will have taken over the club. So that's a huge change, because the current owners aren't they're not part of the militant tendency. They're American capitalists, but at the same time they have run the club in a way, often to the huge frustration of Liverpool fans. They've run it in a kind of sustainable way, and there is something that at the same time, I think, for all the complaints that Liverpool fans have, especially in a summer like this, about a lack of signings, there is something that I think they feel that resonates with them more than a different type of ownership, a brasher, like a Chelsea-style ownership. Now, I don't think the Bezos ownership will come in and spend a huge amount of money. I think they'll look to increase revenue. They may even look to reduce costs where they can. But I think it's a significant change. I think on the other point as well, Matt, about the team, I think it is Isak is a really important figure in how Liverpool do this season, because he is the person who was signed to replace the goals of Mo Salah, not whoever they get in at this late stage. Now, last year he had a bad injury in January, but he got an easy ride for his lack of fitness before that. He went on strike and didn't go through pre-season, and he just looked totally off it. It's really important that he is back. And if he's back, you could be having a conversation about Liverpool that is very different to the one that we're having now, because it could be like they could be the team that challenge Arsenal. I would say as well, I think he was plagued by injury. Wirtz had some injuries, as Tony alludes. So I'd say Wirtz was more plagued by sort of ennui rather than any kind of injury. I've rarely seen a player with such a transfer fee who is so passive. Like, he is just, if he's suffering from any injury, he's like a kind of, a sort of an heiress after World War One, constantly having like fainting fits. You know what I mean? He's just, his inability to take control.
Oh, you killed him there, Pete.
He's just inability to show any authority in matches is a real worry for Liverpool. And I think in the system that Iriola is going to play now, he needs to deliver. And because, Iriola is stressing, and the reason people wanted him was back to the intensity of Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool. There's going to be hard running. There's going to be all the drive and energy that they had under Klopp. Now, in that, Wirtz is playing as a traditional number 10. And Klopp's famous line was that a counter press is a better playmaker than any number 10 because of what the opportunities it gave forwards through that swarming of defence. Now, if you have a number 10 in that system, and now Wirtz does run, but if you have a number 10 in that system, I don't know how it's going to work. So I think Liverpool are going to be hugely vulnerable unless he has a sort of a personality transplant.
Okay, we need to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk about Manchester United, Leeds, Chelsea and whatever else we can get to with Tony Cascarino, Dion Fanning and Gavin Cooney after this. Welcome back to the last part of our Premier League preview. We'll go in a moment to Tony Cascarino and to Dion Fanning, but Gavin Cooney, Manchester United. Michael Carrick got the gig last year on a temporary basis. As caretakers tend to do at Old Trafford, did well enough to be given the job full time. Could Manchester United end up being, because of the problems at Liverpool and Manchester City, the closest challengers to Arsenal?
I actually think they might. Maybe these Man United banter years are finally coming to an end. It's been kind of quiet against Manchester United. There hasn't been any kind of frenzy outbreaks of crazy news from there in quite a while. Carrick did a brilliant job when he took over last season. Won his first two games against Arsenal and Man City and went on to win more points from that stage to the end of the season than anyone else. The recruitment of in the off-season has been kind of quietly impressive. Yuri Tielemans is a brilliant signing for, you know, in relative terms, next to nothing. He's been an outstanding midfielder in the Premier League for years. They've signed Andre Santos from Chelsea. It looks like they'll eventually sign Carlos Baliba of Brighton. They've really added numbers in midfield and crucially mobility, having got Casemiro off the wage bill. I think Sesko was quite impressive in the final few weeks of last season. He's a very promising striker. Bruno Fernandes is maybe the most outstanding individual attacker outside of Erling Haaland in the league. There are still question marks over the defence. Luke Shaw is still tenured at left back, which is kind of remarkable. The big question for them is how they deal with the rhythm of returning to the Champions League and playing 2-3 games a week. But there are actually, I think, fewer question marks around Manchester United than there are around Liverpool, Man City and Chelsea. And as a result, I actually think United will have a pretty good season.
Tony, what do you think?
Well, again, what Gavin said, in the midfield, it's been really bolstered. I was a couple of years ago, Matt, first game of the season, I did a Brighton versus Ipswich when Carlos Baliba played, and he was a teenager at the time. And I was shocked how much running he'd done. He was literally going from one player to another, and his energy was incredible. The one downside to him, I mean, he had a mixed season last year, and it was there was lots of talk of him going for 100 million last summer. You know, Chelsea were interested. He looked like he had his head turned, and he had a pretty in and out season. Now, Manchester United took him for 60 if they get it over the line. And you've got a real energy player in there. He can run for fun, Matt. But one thing he does, and he's a little bit reckless, is sometimes he just mistimes things, and you might get red cards with Carlos Baliba because he just sees it and then he's there. He's on top of it. And I just think it might come a bit of a problem for them. But they bolstered their midfield. They did their forward line last year. You know, Mbeumo, Cunha, Sesko. They boosted all that. And then they've done the midfield. And again, defensively, how will they go? But they've been a very... If you look at their results, Matt, second part of the season, you know, the reason why Carrick got the job was because they had gone from a team that won a lot of points in 2026 in the early part and to the end of the season. So I think a lot of United fans will be way more optimistic, even though they might not have done the business they'd expect, like some of the other bigger clubs have done. They'll be pretty happy with what's happening so far.
Tony, I'm actually going to stay with you for a moment because your old club Chelsea is the next one I have on my list. And Chelsea are doing their usual thing of spending small fortunes and new transfers. Now they're desperately trying to get rid of players. And, you know, you wonder, will they be able to get the prices they're demanding? But behind the scenes, there's a major issue with the ownership of the club. And Clearlake might take full control, buy out Todd Boehly and the other lad. But if they do so, it might be at a price which forces them to write down the value of the investment they've made in Chelsea, or if they do buy it out to keep the value up, they'll overpay. Chelsea looks to me like an incredible financial mess. Maybe that won't impact what happens with Xabi Alonso and his new team on the pitch, but what do you expect from them?
First and foremost, they've got a lot of very good players. You know, they really have, Matt. You know, if Fernandes doesn't go, they've still got, you know, Caicedo in midfield, who's a high energy, as we know, ball winning midfielder. They've lost Cucurella. But they're honestly, Matt, they've got players all over the pitch. The worst part of their team is probably the goalkeeper, Sanchez, which has come under scrutiny for the last two or three years, but looks like, you know, we're seeing Alonso stay with him. But the Chelsea club has been a conveyor belt, Matt. That's what it's been. And it's, you know, it's literally the generation game with Chelsea. As you're watching them all go in, you know, it's just one after the other. Who comes in, who goes out. But I'll tell you what as well, though, Matt. They didn't have to get some good fees. Santos, who went to Manchester United, he's a good player. But did I see a £50 million fee on his head? No, I didn't, Matt. Hopefully it turns out for United like that. But Chelsea have been this type of club that they found finance. They found finance all the time, to whether it's been through the sale of a hotel, whether it's from the women's team and, you know, the branding and third kits. I mean, it's just gone on and on and on, Matt, that they seem to find money for a team that get, what, 41,000, because the capacity at Stamford Bridge is about 41,000, whereas the Tottenham, Arsenal, 60, you know, Man United, 60 plus, 70, all them teams who can find more revenue, Chelsea have been able to compete alongside all of them.
Yeah, which Diop makes me very suspicious. Actually, now that Tony's talked about the generation game, I'm wondering, is Xabi Alonso more Larry Grayson or Bruce Forsyth? But anyway, but when it comes to Chelsea, I mean, can we believe the finances? In some respects, you know, they've already gotten away with things that I think other clubs wouldn't have got away with, in much the same way Manchester City. Remember those 115 charges, which we're never going to get an answer on?
Well, yeah, Richard Masters addressed that during the week by not addressing it, really. I think the Chelsea story, I think Chelsea on the field now with a manager like Xabi Alonso, and they've given, you know, power to him. He's got the title of manager. It's significant things given how they've gone about things in the past. Morgan Rodgers, a very good signing for them. You would think, right, and again, without European football, there's an opportunity for them there. But as you say, Matt, the financial element of it and what's going to happen in this, if his stake is sold to Clearlake, and what is going to come out or what will be revealed, if anything is revealed as we learn more about their finances.
And your man Mark Walter in particular is in big trouble in the United States.
And as you said, like, Chelsea have avoided sanctions, and I think There is a scenario where you look at this and 6-9 months down the line, people are asking, how was this not waved through because they were given punishments, but how was the light touch regulation, if you like, applied to this entity? The way, you know, going back in time to bigger financial catastrophes and what light touch regulation did, and what, you know, I think this is a scenario where football could be examining itself in the same way and wondering, Look at the evidence that was here and why didn't we do something about it?
I'm looking at the time available to us, so I need to get through a few things. Gavin, are Tottenham spending like drunken sailors?
They are. Daniel Levy's out of the building and the purse strings are open. Extraordinary fees committed to players, but you would have to say they have improved the team. Mateus Fernandez, good signing from West Ham in midfield. Tonali's come from Newcastle.
Savinho worth $85 million?
I don't know really who's worth anything anymore, to be honest. Maybe if you take him or whatever they're paying for Marmoush, the total fee for both players may be worth it. But they have to be better. It's a low bar, having finished 17th twice in a row, but De Zerbi has kind of got them out of trouble. He's had a full season to work, pre-season to work with them. They won't have European distractions next season, so it'll be better than 17th.
Dion, should we feel sorry for Aston Villa that, you know, here they are, Europa League champions in the Champions League, and they're losing players like Tielemans, Digne. They have lost Morgan Rodgers, as you mentioned. Ollie Watkins is the next one looking to go out the door.
Yeah, it's it is a shame. Like, the, you know, Emery's done such a great job there, and I think, you know, for Villa fans, there is the frustration, the feeling that, you know, the regulations, the financial regulations as they currently are loaded against, you know, teams like clubs like theirs, and as they see the breakup of this team, it is very tough on them because they have consistently challenged. They have consistently, they've won trophies. Emery, as I said, has really done an excellent job there. And you would love, you know, in an ideal world, because Villa are a huge club, in an ideal world, they would be building on that.
And Newcastle, just stay with you, Dion, on this. I mean, should we have sympathy for Newcastle fans? Or is it, should we say, well, look, you were happy to be bought out by the Saudis. You got one trophy in it, so good enough for you.
I would like land closer to the latter there than the former. When you think of the Newcastle fans, you know, wearing tea towels on their heads and various things, celebrating the arrival of Saudi ownership and thinking they were going to overlooking any question marks, ethical question marks, or, you know, human rights question marks, and just thinking this is we deserve this, we are entitled to this. And I think that it demonstrates the huge flaw in the ownership model. You can't even call it a model because the Premier League, they haven't created this by design as much as allowed it to happen. But the ownership structures of so many clubs means that you are at the whim. You are at the whim of, they haven't not spent money this year. Like the players have been allowed to leave, but they have signed some players too. But clearly the interest or the belief in the Newcastle project isn't there from Saudi Arabia or their investment fund, at the same way that it isn't there in LIV Golf anymore.
Tony, I think every year everyone expects the three promoted teams to go back down again. Last year it didn't happen. Sunderland memorably got to the Europa League, although I suspect that being in the Europa League this year and not having had the money to go and buy loads of players, the Sunderland might struggle this year. Leeds stayed up and Leeds have now invested, not perhaps as heavily as modern Leeds fans might have wanted, but it seems pretty judiciously. You mentioned how Ipswich are doing what Sunderland did and spending enormous sums of money in rebuilding the team. Can you see any of Ipswich, Coventry and Hull staying up? And if one or all of them were to stay up, who would go down?
Well, I mean, Hull are the obvious ones that you'd say would go down, Matt. I feel that's a little bit unfair on them. I did both games in the playoff game against Millwall and then the final against Middlesbrough, and they were sensational. Didn't concede a goal, played three at the back, did it brilliantly well.
But John Egan essential to that at the back as well.
John done great. Done really, really great. And he played at the heart of that defence towards the end of the season. He was terrific. So, yeah, I mean, I actually think Newcastle are in a bit of danger, Matt. I really do. I think the selling that they've done and the quality they lost, I think your Leeds will be fine. You've got a big physical team. Trafford coming in, I'd like to think I don't get the Man City one, Matt. I mean, Maresca wants to always play out from the back. And Donnarumma, that is not his strength. That's James Trafford's strength. And now he's gone to Leeds. Now, I'd like to think that Harry Wilson coming to your team, who will add goals. He's not the quickest, but he's got a real eye for a goal. I think he'll add a bit more to Leeds. So I don't see your team, Matt, being any danger at all.
One last one, Gavin. And there are so few Irish names we've mentioned. John Egan might have been the first. What about Brentford under Keith Andrews with Caoimhín Kelleher in goal, Nathan Collins as centre-back? Will they continue to be a top-half team?
And Duffer on the touchline alongside Keith Andrews this season as well. I think they should be fine. They narrowly missed out on Europe last season on goal difference, but it does free up their schedule compared to the other teams around them who will be playing. They've recruited an impressive midfielder called Sangare from Lens in France. I think they'll be fine, to be honest. I don't think they're in anywhere. They won't be in relegation trouble, even though their wage bill would suggest that success every season is staying up. I think they'll be very comfortably mid-table.
That is all the time I've been allowed to do in this. I would talk to the three of you for a lot longer if I was let, but I'm not. We're at the end of the show, but I look forward to talking to you in detail throughout the course of the season. Tony Cascarino, Dion Fanning and Gavin Cooney, thank you all very much.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.